You know, I have 9 o'clock on the dot, and I see that Don Salerno is in the back, the enforcer. And so I don't want to be late. So why don't we go ahead and start? Welcome to the last day of Mises University. Hope you're excited about the courses and other activities that we have today. Those of you planning to take the exam, the oral exam, we wish you the best of luck. Small bills, unmarked bills are preferred when you come in to have your exam. This morning, I want to talk to you about applications of Austrian economics to business and management. And mainly, we're going to talk about practical applications, applications that are useful for practicing managers, entrepreneurs, financiers, and so forth. But there's also a kind of a subtext of this talk, which relates to the place of Austrian economic theory and application in business education. So as you know, most of you are economics majors or you've had many economics courses. You know that among professional economists, academic economists in particular, there are many scholars, prominent scholars, who are strong proponents of the Austrian approach, the sorts of folks who are on the faculty here this week, maybe some professors you've had before. But you know there are also some academic economists who are not particularly friendly toward the Austrian approach. There aren't that many who are sort of in the middle, right? So many economists have strong feelings one way or the other towards Austrian economics. And that, of course, has many can be beneficial, but poses some particular challenges as well for students and researchers, et cetera. In business schools, among academic researchers and teachers who specialize in management or entrepreneurship, or accounting, or marketing, or real estate, or insurance, these scholars tend to be more open to alternative approaches and are a little bit more agnostic about sort of, you know, school of thought within an academic discipline. You know, what I mean is, you know, in Karl Menger's day and through, you know, until the early part of the 20th century, the so-called Austrian approach was widely respected and, you know, part of the mainstream within, you know, within the economics profession, even at elite institutions and so forth. But that isn't true today. In schools of management and business, Austrian economics is still quite highly regarded in many places. You don't see that many sessions at the American Economic Association annual meeting on applications of Austrian economics to X, Y, or Z. But you see many such sessions at the leading professional associations in management and entrepreneurship and other fields of business. So what is it about business school researchers and teachers that makes them more open to Austrian economics than many economists? You know, of course, partly, as I say, I think that's because there's a more vocational interest among researchers and teachers in business schools. And they're interested in ideas and theories and frameworks and models that seem useful, that work, that are relevant. And they're not so picky about what label you attach to those particular approaches. But if you think about it, right, compared to other flavors of economic analysis, Austrian economics is extremely practical. Austrian economics fits well with our experiences of the real world. Austrian theories and concepts make sense to business practitioners and other professionals in a way that, you know, some mathematical general equilibrium model does not. Okay, so I want to start by thinking about what is it about Austrian economics that makes it so practical? How can we characterize Austrian economics as a very practical subject? Well, of course, at its core, the Austrian approach to markets and prices is, as we've said many times this week, causal and realistic. Austrians offer a causal, realistic approach to understanding prices and markets and other economic phenomena, right? Causal, coming from the Aristotelian notion that we can explain economic outcomes, prices and quantities and so forth, as the result of purposeful action on the part of human decision makers, right? So economic phenomena don't just sort of magically appear on their own. We don't try to explain a whole bunch of variables in terms of some kind of model of simultaneous determination, right? We trace economic processes through time in a step-by-step cause and effect manner. Also, Austrians are interested in explaining real phenomena, not hypothetical imaginary phenomena. So you never hear Austrian economists talk about trying to explain the perfectly competitive general equilibrium price, right, which exists only on a blackboard or in a computer simulation. Austrians are interested in explaining the actual prices that you would pay this morning if you went to McDonald's to get an Egg McMuffin. Okay, so we're always focusing on reality. Indeed, you know, to be sure, Austrian economic theory is abstract and deductive and logical and so forth. But the reason for using that level of abstraction is to try to explain real phenomena, always interested in the real world. There's some distinctive features of the Austrian approach that make it eminently practical for those in business and management and other walks of life, right? The emphasis, for example, on firm and resource heterogeneity. We recognize that firms are different. We recognize that resources are different. And, you know, you've discussed this already many times this week, probably in the context of macroeconomics, right? And Roger Garrison talks about Keynesian economists describing capital as, you know, the letter K. And it doesn't get more sophisticated than that, right? Austrians are not only interested in, you know, distinctions between Menger's higher order goods and lower order goods, but in much more fine distinctions among different kinds of capital assets, right? We try to explain the value of specific, discrete, marginal units of capital according to principles of marginal productivity, right? We emphasize that productive assets have multiple specificities, as Ludwig Lachmann famously put it, meaning that, you know, this little laser pointer, it isn't equally valuable in all production processes, but nor is it unique only to one particular activity, right? I mean, there are a limited number of things that you can do with these laser pointers. You can point to the screen and highlight a word. You know, you can shoot it up in the air and bring down a plane, I guess. You know, I could throw it at one of you and hit you on the head and get your attention. And so there are a few different things I can, several different purposes to which I can put this laser pointer, but I can't use it to bake bread and I can't use it to transport me, you know, to the next state or whatever. So resources are neither purely specific nor purely general. They have multiple specificities. Their attributes are not objectively given, but are subjectively perceived by entrepreneurs and other agents, right? So it isn't that we're unconcerned with the specific physical attributes of this thing, its size, its weight, its density, and its aerodynamics and so forth. But those characteristics are relevant to human action only as they are interpreted subjectively in the mind of the decision maker. I think someone mentioned in one of the earlier sessions this week a resource like petroleum, right? Of course, petroleum was not a resource in the economically meaningful sense until we figured out how to extract it from the ground and refine it into kerosene and gasoline and so forth. Absent human knowledge of how to transform it and use it, petroleum is simply sticky black goo. Right? And before we had this knowledge, if petroleum was discovered on your land, it, of course, made your land worthless. Because who wants to build a house on a land that has oozy, you know, black, sticky stuff coming out from the ground? A business firm, right? The firm as a productive unit is understood as a bundle of heterogeneous capital resources, organized and reorganized by an entrepreneur, right? So that brings us to entrepreneurship. As I mentioned, I think on Monday or Tuesday, right? Most mainstream economics texts don't even mention the entrepreneur, don't even mention the word, much less provide any analysis of the role played by the entrepreneur in the economy. Yet everybody knows, the person on the street knows, little kids know, right? Everybody knows that entrepreneurs are important agents in society. And because the Austrian school is almost unique in placing the entrepreneur front and center of its discussion of firms and markets and productivity and so forth, that gives the Austrian school a particular appeal to people who recognize that entrepreneurship is important and that we ought to be able to say something about it, right? Austrian economics emphasizes the uncertainty that is inherent in every action, as Mises put it. Uncertainty is almost entirely absent from mainstream principles of economics texts. We point out that heterogeneous productive resources are not combined and recombined into useful consumer goods by magic, right? Or just sort of automatically, right? They have to be acted upon by purposeful agents, specifically entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs exercise judgment about future market conditions. That's what drives the market economy forward, because Austrians handle this and treat this explicitly, it makes the Austrian approach more palatable to those who recognize how real markets work. The role of ownership, right? That being an entrepreneur doesn't simply mean you have good ideas. You also take possession of productive resources. Resources change hands. They're bought and sold. Capital goods are rented and purchased. Firms are bought and sold and restructured and acquired and divested, etc. This is all part of the action of entrepreneurs in trying to organize the economy's capital structure, right, to satisfy the needs of the consumers. Financial markets are particularly important here. Financial markets are not just an add-on to the theory of production, but having financial resources is essential for any production to take place whatsoever. So because Austrians place a lot of weight on these factors, people who understand real markets and recognize that these factors are where the action is tend to be drawn to the Austrian approach or are more sympathetic to the Austrian approach. I want to discuss some of these things in more detail in the time that we have remaining. You know, there are lots of things that we could talk about, lots of potential business and managerial applications or implications of the Austrian approach. We can talk about the nature of competition, right? Competition, if you've studied it in a mainstream economics text, is, well, it's not really clear what it is. It's a sort of imaginary state of affairs in which nobody does anything because all decision makers are teeny, teeny, tiny, and all markets are perfectly competitive. Everyone's a price taker and so forth. If you took the earlier lectures this week on monopoly and competition, you know what I mean. But Austrians understand competition as a process taking place in real time where real actors are competing against each other in the common sense notion of the word competition to try to do a better job at satisfying the needs of the consumers and earning higher profits and so forth. In the field of strategic management, I'll mention this in more detail in just a moment. Many of the dominant approaches sort of put the consumer to the side and focus on what takes place in input markets and attempts to create entry barriers and so forth without recognizing that ultimately the source of economic value and the source of profit for the entrepreneur, right, is the ability to satisfy consumer wants. There's been a recent some new interest among strategy scholars in what's called demand-side strategy, where you start, as Austrians would do, as Karl Menger would do, with consumer valuations, and then work backward to the configurations of resources that generate profit. I'll say more about that in a few minutes. Austrian business cycle theory, of course, is extremely useful and important for business and management professionals. If you understand Austrian business cycle theory, of course, that doesn't guarantee that in an actual boom-bust cycle, you can time it perfectly, right? You know when the bubble will burst. You know how much investment is malinvestment relative to genuinely productive investment and so forth. But being able to watch for the warning signs, being particularly cautious at credit-induced, when you're in the midst of a credit-induced boom and so forth. I mean, that's extremely useful knowledge for the business professional. There are applications for organizational design. Should firms be organized as strict hierarchies, or should there be more bottom-up market-based activity inside the firm? I'll talk about that too. There are particular issues in, for example, accounting about how resources should be priced when they're transferred outside of a market context. In other words, when Division A of a firm transfers a good or service to Division B of the same firm, So there's no market price for that resource, but rather the central managers have to impute some kind of price for accounting purposes. How can they do that, given what we know about how prices are formed in a market? And how does the need to have useful transfer prices constrain what large multi-divisional firms can do? I'll mention that point as well later. And of course, the role of the entrepreneur, not only in the day-to-day activities of the firm, but in stimulating innovation and novelty and creativity, is an area where Austrian economics has a lot of insight. So let's talk about some of these one by one. Let's talk about the Austrian notion of cost. In the early 20th century, many economists would have identified the Austrian school in particular by its approach to cost, right? The notion of cost not as dollar expenditure for purchasing something, but as the value of alternative ends that are foregone when particular means are dedicated to the end in question, the focal end, i.e. opportunity cost, right? Opportunity cost is sort of a fundamental Austrian concept and something that identified the Austrian school in its early years. When you study conventional economics texts, intermediate micro textbooks, cost is introduced, you know, with these sort of cost curve diagrams where you have an upward sloping marginal cost curve and a U-shaped average cost curve and so forth. The emphasis is on explicit costs, right? What do you pay in dollars or euro or whatever to acquire a unit of factor one, a unit of factor two, et cetera? And costs are seen largely as the determinant of firm behavior. So the manager in this Econ 101 diagram, you know, the manager wakes up in the morning and goes and looks to see what are the costs that day and then decides how many widgets to produce. And if he or she is lucky, there's a little bit of profit left over at the end of the day. But you're sort of a slave to this cost structure that is imposed upon you exogenously by the market, whatever that is. So how do you price your product? Well, you take these explicit costs and you add a markup to them, right? Or you look at the relationship between these exogenously given costs and some exogenously given demand curve and calculate the maximum profit and so on. I mean, how many of you have studied these kinds of diagrams in school and learned, you know, how to maximize profit, quote unquote, by drawing these pretty pictures? I used to think when I was a student, when I learned this diagram, I thought, wow, I'm going to call up IBM. I'm going to call up, General Motors, whatever, and say, hey, you know, you guys got problems. You want profit? I know how to maximize your profit. Okay. If you'll just show me your cost curves and your demand and marginal revenue curves, I'll do the calculus for you. I can take the derivatives and I'll show you how much quantity will maximize profit. You know, I can imagine you walking into IBM and making this little speech, you know, and it would just be a few minutes before the big security guys, you know, would haul me away. This isn't anything like what actual pricing, how pricing decisions work. And this isn't the right way to think about cost, right? So Austrians emphasize that costs are not exogenously given, but costs emerge endogenously from the action and behavior of entrepreneurs who are acting in factor markets, trying to acquire resources to satisfy what they perceive to be future consumer demands, right? All costs are opportunity costs, of course. Even inside the firm, right? Using a particular resource or a unit of labor to perform one activity means that the firm does not get the benefit of how that resource could be used or unit of labor could be used for other activities within the firm, right? We recognize from Austrian production theory that what we call a cost from the point of view of the entrepreneur is just a price that emerges in another market, right, in a factor market. So the cost of acquiring a unit of labor, that's the price that emerges in the market where people are buying and selling or renting and leasing units of labor, right? So costs are not something other than prices. They're prices in intermediate goods markets, okay? And the entrepreneur sometimes, but not always, right, has some control over the prices of the factors that the entrepreneur uses, right? If I'm in construction or I'm in some kind of manufacturing business and I need, you know, little nails little standard 1-inch nails, you know, and I go down to Walmart or I go to Home Depot or Lowe's and I say, hey, what do you guys charge for these little nails? 2 cents each. Okay, give me 1,000 of them. Okay, in a case like that, because there are many, many users of these little 1-inch nails, right? You know, it's probably not the case that I can bid the price down unless I'm a very large user. If I'm a big user, maybe I could, right? If I'm buying, you know, millions of these nails at a time, I can negotiate with the wholesaler to get a better price. But if I'm a small business owner, maybe I don't have that much control over the price of the nail. Now, mainstream managerial economics texts infer from that special case, oh, well, factor prices are given to the firm. You take those as given and do some math on them, right? Of course, in many cases, even for smaller firms, the entrepreneur can influence the price that he pays for factors of production by bargaining, right? By shopping around, by negotiating and so forth. And of course, ultimately, where do these factor prices come from? They're the result of the interactions among those who currently own the resource and those who wish to rent or purchase the resource. So just as the market for, the price of tomatoes as a consumer good, right, is determined by the relative valuations of people who want to eat tomatoes and people who have tomatoes and want to get rid of them. And we understand, we have a well-developed theory of how these prices are determined, Bombavik's principle of the marginal pairs, right? The marginal valuations of these buyers and sellers result in an equilibrium price for the tomato. Likewise, for a unit of fast food worker labor or the use of a digging machine for 1 hour or the land on which a particular building can be located or, you know, 2 weeks worth of a highly skilled scientist or engineer's time. Right, all of these factor prices are determined by the same general principles of valuation that apply to any economic goods. Okay, it's also the case that the entrepreneur always has choice over the production method. Right, you say, well, gosh, I'm too small. I can't really negotiate with Home Depot. They won't listen to me on the price of the nails. Well, there are alternatives to those nails. There are other nails. Nails from different vendors, slightly bigger, slightly smaller, screws, glue, maybe chewing gum can be used to put things together, who knows, right? But the entrepreneur never faces sort of given production methods. That's what they say in a mainstream text. Given the factor prices, given the technology, is what they say. What they mean is the production method that you should use. The firm then takes off running and does some math, okay? But of course, what method should I use? I mean, even the simplest goods and services like this kind of a thing, or, you know, Leonard Reed's famous yellow pencil, or a more complicated good or service. There's almost an infinite number of factor combinations that can be used to produce any particular good or service. And that is not given to the entrepreneur exogenously. That's something the entrepreneur has to choose through research and talking to engineers and thinking about how consumers will value different attributes and exercising judgment, right? Using intuition, maybe experimenting, some trial and error, right? But the entrepreneur always can influence the prices that the entrepreneur pays for factors by choosing different factor combinations, okay? So costs are a choice of the producer, not something imposed on the producer. And so just as we have from the Austrians the explanation for pricing of consumer goods, and then through the principle of imputation, which we talked about on Tuesday, how prices for intermediate goods are determined, right? This gives us a different way of thinking about the nature of cost, how we account for cost, how entrepreneurs treat cost, and so forth. As a footnote, right, if you think about Mises' famous 1920 article on economic calculation, which Professor Salerno discussed, I think on Tuesday, right? Really, Mises' argument about the impossibility of rational economic planning under socialism is a cost accounting argument, right? Those of you who don't like accounting or think accounting is boring, accountants are people who wear green eye shades and can't get a date in college or whatever. I'm sorry, but accounting is really at the heart of Mises' critique of socialism, right? It's the ability of the central planner to make rational decisions about the allocation of productive resources in the absence of meaningful numbers that makes it impossible, right? That's the nature of the impossibility of rational economic planning under socialism, is the absence of numbers, meaningful numbers, that the decision maker can attach to alternative factors, i.e. prices. The absence of market prices, no private property, no market prices for factors, no way for the decision maker to determine what is the most effective use of resources, which factor combinations to use, whether a particular consumer good should be produced at all, and so forth, right? You might have noticed that there's a great article by Murray Rothbard. It's called the it's written in 1976 on the calculation debate. And he makes the point that the Mises economic calculation problem, or Mises' argument about economic calculation, you know, it's not really about socialism per se. Socialism is the best known application, but it's really a much more general argument about the need for markets for factors, right? How economic decision making requires real meaningful prices for intermediate goods. The most important application, and certainly in Mises' day, the sort of hot political issue and social issue, was whether this could work on an economy-wide level, right? But even within the firm, even the large firm may have issues with the ability to perform economic calculation, depending on what inputs are used and the availability of market prices for particular inputs. So it's the socialist calculation problem is really a cost accounting issue. Okay, Mises points out in his book Bureaucracy, which I highly recommend if you haven't read before, published in 1944. It's a short book, and in my view, Joe may, I don't know what Joe thinks, Mises' brief summary of the calculation argument in Bureaucracy is much clearer and much more concise than his explanation in the 1920 article in the 1922 book. You know, and much more clear than anything that Salerno's ever written. No, I'm just kidding. Mises distinguishes among two different managerial techniques, what he calls profit management and bureaucratic management. And what he means by profit management is sort of the way that large organizations can be operated when the products of those organizations, the goods and services that are produced, are bought and sold in markets and have prices. Right, bureaucratic management is the term Mises uses for large organizations that produce goods and services that are not bought and sold on markets. Right, so the Army, the Post Office, the Red Cross, the Mises Institute. Right, I mean, a nonprofit organization produces some outputs, and you can buy books in the Mises bookstore and T-shirts and so on. But the Mises Institute is not a profit-maximizing entity in the way that that Microsoft is, or a car company would be, and so forth, right? The goal of the Mises Institute is to produce knowledge and understanding, and so forth, right? These are things that are not easily measurable. So, according to Mises, in an organization in which outputs are measurable, it's possible to use a significant degree of decentralization. A lot of delegation is possible. Right, so you know, if Microsoft produces word processing programs and web browsers, and here's a little Microsoft mouse right here, right? It's possible to delegate a lot of authority to the mouse division of Microsoft. Central managers can make some assessments about the relative performance of the managers in the mouse division compared to the managers in the Microsoft Word division, right? By looking at divisional income and loss statements. Right? You can see how much profit is the mouse division contributing to the overall company, the bottom line of the company. And from that, we can incentivize, we can give rewards to and discipline and so forth, those who are in charge of making the decisions on the mouse. In a nonprofit organization or a government organization, you don't have those same measures of performance, right? We all know that, you know, that we were actually last night as we were walking to Chipotle, the group that I was in, the person who was in front of our group stopped at the street corner and said, well, you know, the sign says don't walk. You know, we shouldn't cross the street because there's a police car right there. you know, I was thinking, well, it's a college town. They're probably not going to give a ticket for jaywalking, right? But my friend pointed out, yeah, they sometimes do in this town. And I realized, you know, it's really close to the end of the month. Right? So imagine that the, you know, you have, if you have police officers and you give them promotions or awards based on the amount of ticket revenue generated per officer, you can see how that leads to some potentially bad outcomes, right? Because the services of the police are not themselves priced and traded in markets. It's hard to come up with performance measurement for individual police officers. Therefore, it's unlikely that the police captain will say to the police officer, hey, you do whatever you want, you know, just maximize the profit of your unit. Okay, that leads to all kinds of potentially bad outcomes. What Mises calls bureaucratic management. And by the way, that's not a pejorative for Mises, right? He simply means this is the managerial technique you use in situations like that. It's much more hierarchical, much more rigid. There are fixed rules. There are policies and procedures that are applied to tell individuals in the organization what to do. You have to follow the rules, right? Every police movie or TV show about detectives or cops you've ever seen, right, always has a scene where the protagonists are brought into the boss's office, the captain, and the captain yells at them because, you know, they were shooting, blowing stuff up or whatever. And the police captain always says, you know, you guys never follow the book. You got to do things by the book. Have you ever thought, you know, what's the book? What is the book? Right? The book is the policies and procedures manual. This is how you handle this situation. This is how you handle that situation. And in the police force, that's what you're supposed to do, not, well, you figure it out and we'll judge the results. You can do that at Microsoft because you have ways to measure the results. You don't have that for the police department, right? So the only way that profit management in a multi-unit firm is feasible, according to Mises, is when you have good divisional statements of income and loss, right? Of good statements of net income, which is a cost accounting issue. Accounting practices themselves, right, of course, evolve and emerge over time. The particular conventions that are adopted in one society or another about how certain, you know, what's the appropriate depreciation rate and how do you handle overhead costs and what things should be reported to stakeholders and what things don't need to be reported and so forth. These themselves are institutions that emerge on the market, right? Just like any other set of standards or conventions or norms. Some good work by Thomas Taylor on this. So my point is Mises doesn't recommend a particular accounting technique, value-based costing, activity-based costing, or economic value added or whatever. But these particular techniques are those that emerge as beneficial social institutions when entrepreneurs and other actors are negotiating over resource use and pricing and so forth. Okay, we talked about entrepreneurship earlier in the week. So I'll just mention a few, I'll remind you of a few key points that, again, fit in with this theme of why the Austrian approach makes sense to business professionals, right? Right. In, as we said before, in this sort of long-run equilibrium state, Mises evenly rotating economy, all factors of production get a return equal to their discounted marginal revenue product, right? Management gets a return equal to its discounted marginal revenue product and so forth. Capitalists, those who lend money to the firm, and the business owner in his or her capacity as a capitalist in advancing payments to factors in advance of sale to consumers, right, earn an interest return. But there are no economic profits and losses. Why? Because in this long-run equilibrium, there's no uncertainty about the future. Everybody knows what's going to happen tomorrow. You know what consumers will pay. You know how much you can afford to pay to factors and so forth. But of course, day to day, outside of this long-run equilibrium state, in other words, in reality, right, there is uncertainty about future market demands. There is uncertainty about what prices will be in the future. And so entrepreneurs earn profits or losses based on their ability to anticipate correctly the prices that consumers will be willing to pay. So this is the unique role of the entrepreneur in the Misesian system. It's to make the production of goods and services possible, right? The entrepreneur is the agent who has a vision of what the future might look like, right? And says, well, I can buy factors of production today and organize them in a certain way and produce things that I can then sell in the future at a certain price. And it won't, and I can buy those resources today at a price less for expenditures less than what I think my future revenues will be. And I go for it, right? And if I'm correct, if my judgments are accurate, then I'll earn economic profit, monetary profit. If I'm otherwise, I'll earn an economic loss, right? So notice that this is a much more general role for the entrepreneur to play than the more narrow roles you sometimes see in the literature. So you know, innovation in Joseph Schumpeter's sense, introducing new stuff, new goods and services, new ways to produce things. I mean, that's encompassed within this broader definition of entrepreneurship, but not uniquely identified with it, right? Even the management of ongoing operations using tried and true techniques and more or less familiar consumer products in mature markets and so forth also involves the organization of heterogeneous capital resources under uncertainty. So that is also entrepreneurial. It's not quite the same thing as discovery, right? The way Kirzner describes it, because in the Misesian world, there's nothing to discover. There are no prophets sitting out there in, you know, kind of in the ether, waiting for somebody to stumble upon them and seize them, right? Prophets only make, the concept of prophet is only meaningful ex post, right? After action has been taken and the result of action can be assessed and judged profitable or not profitable, okay? So notice that in this broad conception of entrepreneurship, the entrepreneur has to take ownership of productive resources. The entrepreneur must exercise judgment about how those resources should be used. So the entrepreneur, even the pure theoretical entrepreneur of Mises' system, is a very real flesh and blood actor, right? This is an agent who is driving the market economy forward, not sort of hovering above the market or in the background behind the market. But this is really what when Mises calls the entrepreneur the driving force of the market economy. This is the function that he has in mind, okay? What implications does the Misesian theory of entrepreneurship have for profit, right? Well, again, profit is not the same thing as interest, right? I mean, you could say that if you're a lender, interest is like a good thing. I'm happy to have an interest payment. I like interest. It's a reward. It's a benefit, whatever. And if you use the word profit in a kind of a sloppy way to mean a good thing that I get, right, then you might easily confuse the two. But you know, interest as a reward for foregoing consumption in the present in exchange for consumption in the future, that's a distinct category from the reward you get from bearing uncertainty successfully, i.e. profit, okay? The reason this is important, as Mises and others have pointed out, is that you know, if you just look at a firm's income statement, right, what in accounting terms is considered net income is really a composite of pure entrepreneurial profit, interest, and even the sort of implicit wage or opportunity wage of the owners of the firm. Right, so in accounting, we don't necessarily break these things down the way we would as economists, right? Because you know, if I'm the owner of the firm, then I'm using my labor and my decision-making ability to organize resources, and I get a return for that, right? I'm paying my factors of production, paying my workers today, and getting the money from the consumers, you know, tomorrow or next year. So I'm foregoing some present consumption in exchange for future consumption. That's interest, right? And I'm also, if I'm successful, right, I have receipts in excess of my discounted, you know, factor costs, right? So I have an economic profit. So it's up to the economist, conceptually, we have to try to distinguish or decompose net income into the profit component, an interest component, and an implicit wage component. So economic profit is not the same thing as accounting profit. Right, accounting profit includes economic profit, but also other sources of returns as well. Think of profit as a functional category, you know, not a line item on the income statement. Of course, profit is not some sort of automatic return to capital, as certain prominent French economists with best-selling economics books on Amazon seem to think, right? I mean, the whole I wrote a couple of blog posts on the Piketty book, and of course, you know, pointing out flaws or errors in what Piketty does. I mean, it's almost kind of a sport now, but it's not a very challenging sport. It's like, you know, shooting, as I think P.J. O'Rourke once put it, you know, it's like, you know, shooting, hunting dairy cattle with a high-powered rifle and scope. But one of the, I mean, a lot of people point out data errors and sort of arbitrary choices that he made and putting series together and so forth. But even just conceptually, right, the basic idea of Piketty's book is that, you know, the long-run determinants of economic performance, you know, it's comparing the growth rate of income with the growth rate of profit, right? The profit as a return to capital. So in Piketty's model, right, if you have capital, by which he means a big bunch of money, it almost automatically generates a return. You just set it down and walk away, and you come back the next day, and it's like 10% bigger. Okay. Of course, that's not how profit is generated. Profit is generated by the acts of entrepreneurs under uncertainty and so forth. There's no, even the concept of a rate of return on capital doesn't make sense within a Misesian framework, right? Because capital is a stock of heterogeneous resources, right? And remember, profit is not a rate. Profit is an amount, right? Profit is a flow. So your profit is X dollars. Now, if you want to take that number, if you want to take the number that that you earned in profit, and then add a denominator, you want to divide it by the market value of your capital stock or your total sales. That's fine. There's no reason you can't do that, and there may be perfectly legitimate reasons from an accounting point of view why you want to compute some kind of return on investment or return on sales or whatever. But we shouldn't be misled in doing so into thinking that, oh, well, therefore profit is best understood as the growth rate of the capital of your capital or something like that. No, profit is an amount that you get from the successful bearing of uncertainty. And your profits might be large, your profits might be small. Right, they're not a function of your the value of your capital or the volume of sales or whatever. Okay, and of course, obviously, profit is not some sort of markup over production costs. Okay, as this sort of strange Ricardian view. Okay, let me say a couple words about strategic management or strategizing. Right, what for years was the dominant approach in strategic, you know, analysis of firm strategy, right? By strategy, I mean the decisions that are made by managers to try to be successful, right? How do firms actually go about earning profits? What should they do? What things should they look at? The dominant approach is what is sometimes called the strategic positioning approach, and it's associated most famously with Michael Porter. He's a Harvard Business School professor who wrote the all-time best-selling book in strategy is Porter's 1980 treatise called Competitive Strategy. And essentially what Porter does is a little bit of a caricature, but it's almost as if, so if you take neoclassical welfare economics or neoclassical industrial organization economics and then take the welfare conclusions and flip them on their head, you get Porter's approach to strategy. In other words, when you take mainstream Econ 101, they teach you about competition and monopoly. They say that, well, perfect competition is ideal. That's the ideal state of the world because economic profits under perfect competition are zero, right? In long-run equilibrium, there's zero economic profit. No firm has market power, right? Market power in the mainstream approach. If a firm has market power, then it can exploit consumers, right? It can extract consumer surplus and get it in the form of profit. And how do you do that? Well, you construct barriers to entry to keep other firms out of your market so consumers are forced to buy your product. I mean, depending on if you took that course, if you had a really kind of nasty anti-market professor, they might have used this kind of language. It is exploitation of the consumer by these evil firms with downward sloping demand curves and market power and so forth. Porter says, well, so let's assume that's the right way to understand markets, but now you're the evil capitalist exploiter, right? How do you do it? Well, you don't want perfect competition, right? You want entry barriers. You want market power. You want monopoly power. It's like a how-to of how to get monopoly power from a neoclassical economics perspective. Well, you try to, you know, limit the number of firms that are in your industry so you can use predatory pricing or other sort of pricing strategies, particular kinds of marketing and advertising approaches. You can go to the government and lobby to get a tariff or a quota or a patent or whatever to try to make it illegal for other people to compete with you. Or to put it another way, if you don't have control over all those things, you should look for industries in which those characteristics are already there. Right? So if a firm is deciding what industry to be in, you don't want to be in an industry where it's really competitive in the neoclassical sense of competition. Find an industry that you can monopolize easily. Go into that one, right? I mean, there's a lot of you know, interesting insights that come out of thinking of the world this way. But the basic flaw in this kind of strategic positioning approach is that that's not what competition is. That's not where profits come from, okay? If we understand markets the way Austrians do, we think that, well, maybe the source of superior performance for a firm is not how much monopoly power or market power it has. You know, especially if we think that the concept of market power is meaningless to begin with, that's not going to be a very useful technique for managers trying to make money, right? So now, there are other approaches that have been adopted within the strategy literature. So one that I think is an improvement over the positioning approach is a so-called resource-based or capabilities view of strategy, right? In which, you know, superior performance, the performance of if a firm performs better than its rivals, it's not because it has entry barriers or whatever, not because there are entry barriers, but because the firm has better, superior resources to those of its rivals, better workers, superior capital equipment, more productive land, the secret formula for Coca-Cola or whatever that nobody else has. Or maybe because you have a group of people who have worked together for a long time, they've developed particular capabilities. They work together well as a team. They've accumulated some knowledge that is not easily replicable by other firms. So the idea is if you have resources and capabilities that are better than those of other firms, and other firms cannot easily copy or imitate your resources and capabilities, then you'll perform better, right? You'll earn higher profits than other firms. There's a lot of truth to the resource-based approach, but there are some problems with it, right? I mean, one that we sort of hinted at in the entrepreneurship lecture is that just having superior resources per se may not be a source of profit for the firm if you have to pay a lot to get those resources, right? You know, if you want to hold an event, if you want to hold an Austrian economics event and make money from selling tickets to that event, you know, and you want to hire Joe Salerno as your keynote speaker, I got to pick on somebody. He's in the room, right? That's probably not going to be very profitable for you as the organizer of the event because Salerno don't come cheap, right? You got to pay a really big speaking fee to get Salerno to come to your event. So Salerno will make a lot of money from that because he's the one who owns the unique resource, i.e. himself. The organizer of the event is only going to make money if he can somehow pay Salerno less than what Salerno could get, you know, less than Salerno's rack rate, being at a discount on the Salerno rate or something like that. Really, the way to make money as the organizer of the event is to create a unique combination, right? If Salerno on his own can command, you know, $5,000 for a speech, and Klein on his own can command, well, it'd be more like $20,000 compared to Salerno, right? But let's say that when Klein and Salerno are on a panel together, because of the way they interact and play off each other and finish each other's sentences or whatever, they're worth more than the combined. They're not worth $25,000. They're worth, you know, $35,000 or whatever. Then the organizer can get something worth $35,000. But he only has to pay Salerno his next, you know, what he could get in his next best speaking engagement, $5,000. He only has to pay Klein what Klein can get in his next best next, you know, best opportunity, say 20 grand, much more, of course. In other words, you can add value by having unique combinations of resources, but finding those unique combinations is not easy, right? It's not automatic. It may be difficult, and there may be other attempts to get those unique combinations as well. I mean, people miss this idea of the combination sometimes. You hear companies say, you know, our company is the best because we have the best people. And I sometimes think, well, wait a minute. But I mean, if you have to pay a lot for those best people, you may actually not make any money because best people, really high skilled workers, you have to pay for them. So it can't be the case that your company is profitable because you have the best workers. You know, it might be that, you know, my company is really successful because I have the dumbest workers around, right? What matters is what I have to pay for the workers relative to the value they generate for me, not how good they are, right? If I can get low-quality workers but pay way below their discounted marginal revenue product, I get a profit, right? One problem with these sort of approaches, the resource and capabilities approach as well, is that they sometimes tend to be overly static, right? So if I have these resources today, I can produce goods and services today, and that gives me profit that I can just keep earning as long as I have these wonderful resources, right? But consumer demand changes, technology changes, the institutional environment changes, business cycles change, regulation changes, and so forth. So any advantages over my rivals that I can obtain from resource superiority may be short-lived. So sometimes you hear business strategists talk about strategy as the search for sustained competitive advantage, superior performance that is durable, that lasts over time. But that may be impossible in a world of genuine uncertainty, right? All such advantages may be temporary. You actually see some literature now, people are writing books with titles like The Age of Temporary Advantage. And what they mean is because of technology, the internet, you know, rapid pace of economic change, globalization, and so forth, it is no longer possible to earn sustained advantages. Advantages are sort of temporary. You have to be light on your feet, lean and mean, and sort of grasp profit opportunities where you can and then move on to something else. I mean, I'm sympathetic with that approach, but I think profit in this sense has always been temporary in this particular sense. There's never been such a thing as a guaranteed sustained advantage, because we live in a world of genuine uncertainty. For that reason, profit often comes from experimentation and learning, right? Under uncertainty, you know, people say, well, and I've been asked, well, under your theory, by which they mean the Misesian Austrian theory, you know, how does the entrepreneur know what the future prices will be? And the answer is, the entrepreneur doesn't know. The entrepreneur makes a judgment about the future, and sometimes the entrepreneur is correct, and sometimes the entrepreneur is incorrect. Now, there are two kinds of ex post processes that guide the market economy as a whole towards efficiency and productivity, et cetera, right? Either the entrepreneur, when unsuccessful, goes back and looks at, gosh, what did I do wrong? How did I make that mistake? Oh, I didn't think about this. The next time I'll do better, right? So some entrepreneurs, when they're not successful, learn from their mistakes and they get better, right? Other entrepreneurs don't learn from their mistakes, or for whatever reason continue to make losses on a consistent basis. What happens to them? They don't stay entrepreneurs for long, right? So there's sort of there's kind of a Lamarckian selection process where you change and grow and adapt to your circumstances. There's also a Darwinian selection process of survival of the fittest, right? Where those who are not particularly good at making judgments about future market conditions are not able to be entrepreneurs for long, right? So competition both in the product market, where you're trying to find the things that consumers will demand, and competition in the factor market, or the entrepreneur is trying to bid productive factors away from other entrepreneurs, trying to find factors that can be obtained at prices below their discounted marginal revenue products. Both of those sources of competition are important. Neither one is sort of dominant over the other. Okay, I want to stop for a couple questions. So I was going to mention a few things about game theory. I know Lucas Engelhardt has a course, I think it's in the next period, on game theory. I don't want to steal Lucas's thunder, except to note in passing, a lot of the academic literature on strategy and some of the more popular literature as well uses game theory and describes game theory as sort of the ultimate tool, the best tool for use in strategic analysis. And I have kind of a in all things, I'm a man of balance and moderation, right? So I think there are some potentially useful insights that come out of thinking about strategic interaction with sort of a game theoretic mindset. But almost all of those insights can be obtained just by thinking about it. You don't need math. You don't need complicated diagrams and equations. Just a little bit of reasoning and maybe some illustrative diagrams, if you like, can be useful. So I don't think the concepts that come out of game theory are all without any value, but the more sophisticated formal models are really not telling you anything that, you know, a few minutes of careful reflection wouldn't also tell you. A lot of my own research is in the economic theory of the firm, which is another area where Austrian economics makes more sense than mainstream economics to most business scholars and business practitioners. Right? The firm's not a mathematical function, a production function. The firm is a collection of assets that are owned and managed by entrepreneurs, as we've discussed already. Rothbard has a very important argument that I hinted at before about how the need for economic calculation limits the size of the firm. Right? People for a while worried that big companies, Microsoft, GM, Google, whatever, you know, would just continue to grow and grow and grow. And so even on a free market, you could have the emergence of one giant company that eventually takes over entire sectors or maybe even an entire economy. And Rothbard showed that this is not a problem. This is not something to worry about because, you know, one giant firm in the whole world would face precisely Mises' calculation problem. Right? Because there would be no markets for inputs and no market prices for inputs, and it would be impossible for decision makers to make efficient resource allocation decisions. The manager of a super large firm cannot perform economic calculation either. As I said before, it's not socialism per se. Socialism is one important manifestation. It's one important circumstance where the economic calculation problem is important, but it's not the only one, right? So there are natural market forces that limit, you know, how large a firm can be horizontally, how vertically integrated it can be, and so forth. Last point I'll make, some Austrian economists have said, well, because Austrian economics is about markets and freedom and private ownership and decentralization and so forth, doesn't it follow that all firms should be as decentralized as possible, right? That, you know, Wikipedia is better than the Encyclopedia Britannica because Wikipedia is bottom up and it's sort of the result of spontaneous order. Some of you may know that Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia, learned about this model from our own Mark Thornton, because he was a student at Auburn University and actually read Hayek and was inspired to set up Wikipedia from reading Hayek and so forth. Therefore, shouldn't all firms be organized like that? And shouldn't we throw out the old corporate hierarchy as kind of a socialist, statist kind of artifact, and all firms should be voluntary and decentralized and everybody, workers should be empowered and all that? And again, balance and moderation. There is a role for that kind of bottom-up order. There's a role for delegation and decentralization in any organization. But there's also a role for hierarchy under particular circumstances and particular places. So, you know, as long as we have a private property regime where the government is not the large firm or the government is not creating large firms, in a purely free society, we would still have large companies. There are good economic reasons to coordinate particular production processes using a more hierarchical method. I have an article coming out in the Sloan Management Review arguing that the death of the hierarchical corporation has been greatly exaggerated, right, to use Mark Twain's overused quip. Okay, so to conclude, Austrian economics is useful for management and business administration. You know, why? Well, remember, Austrian economics is not the same as neoclassical mainstream economics. The theories and propositions that come out of the Austrian approach are qualitative, right? The law of demand is qualitative, not quantitative. But these are very useful functions for entrepreneurs and business people who are attempting to do quantitative work, you know, forecasting or whatever. There's nothing in Austrian economics that says that quantitative forecasting is illegitimate, shouldn't be used, you know, that entrepreneurs shouldn't even use computer simulations if they want to try to predict the future. Those are techniques that real-world entrepreneurs can use to try to anticipate future market prices, but they are just they're tools that are part of entrepreneurial judgment. It's not like a scientific substitute for entrepreneurial judgment. Right, so ultimately, at the end of the day, management, entrepreneurship, you know, these things are an art, not a science. You know, praxeology doesn't tell you that in your company, you should produce this many units of a particular kind of laser pointer and sell them at this price. However, having a solid understanding of praxeology can help the entrepreneur, the manager, in making those kind of decisions in a way that does generate economic profit. So, thank you.